Thank you.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here. We decided to split the discussion in two parts, so I will give a general introduction and overview some of the main sections for testing of physics beyond the standard model with atoms and molecules. And then I will go through some of the examples, and then Andrey will consider the atomic clocks, variation of fundamental constants, and parity violation next time. So first, I don't want it to be just a talk. So here are some general ideas, and hopefully there'll be a lot of questions and a lot of discussion, so stop me at any time. I would like to first talk about just very basic concepts of what are the advantages for searching for physics beyond the standard model with atoms and molecules, and what are the challenges, and what would be nice to have from particle theory. Then I will discuss some of the main tools and describe the main classes of the AMO searches, pretty much following the chapters of our review. That's only two slides. It's pretty much just lists what can be done and what tools are being used. And then I do have three examples where we actually will get through all three, so it's probably unlikely. But and then Andrey will discuss other examples. And both of us can answer questions, of course, both times. And I will be happy to talk at other times. So first, when we use high-energy experiment to test BSM theories, there is a beautiful collaboration between theory and experiment. So the theories are being tested, and whatever is then being ruled out fits back. Unfortunately, that doesn't quite exist for the AMO experiment. So the connections which exist are very weak, and in part going through the AMO theory, so some of us are reading the particle physics papers, and also the results are not necessarily propagated. And I think one of the main goals for the workshops like this and some of the same work, similar workshops in the future years, it's essentially to build this. And if you have ideas to how to actually do it better, then I would love to hear them. So what we actually want to have, we would like to connect very strongly the ideas which are developed for the various theories beyond the standard model, whether it be searches for dark matter, whether it be some specific fifth forces searches, whether it will be variation fundamental constants which can be interpreted as dark matter or not, that those ideas propagate first, hopefully, to AMO theories, and then we can analyze those in terms of potential experimental signals and help with finding specific experimental groups who can actually do those things. One of the problems, which I don't know how much is being realized, that in atomic physics, there are very few theorists, which is not necessarily maybe the case in some of the other fields. Some of the studies which have been done by NSF in one of our workshops was that only 5% of AMO students actually are theorists, which is very low. In the United States, the NSF atomic theory group funds maybe under 50 people, principal investigators, and that's for the entire AMO field. So in this case, the few of us who do work in AMO theory and specifically are interested in the precision measure, precision searches, then making our best efforts from those workshops. On the other hand, we do know a very large fraction of AMO experiment, and for the people who actually do precision measurements, I think between me and Andrey, we probably know everyone, literally. So essentially, we know what the capabilities are, what can be done, and also what can be done in the next 20 years. And hopefully, we may be actually even somewhat pessimistic in clocks. Clocks actually developed much faster than we actually thought possible. The other thing, when I said the AMO physics experiments, there is of course a subsection of that who specifically already do BSM physics, but nevertheless there is a very large number of people who, for example, do quantum computing, but nevertheless can spare several months to actually, with minimal modification of setup, to actually test Lorentz invariance, if they know exactly what to be done and what should be interpreted in this case. So what do we actually need in terms of these connections? So first we need main ideas. And then we need how this BSM physics connects to standard model. So what are the Lagrangian which couples both? Then how to reduce this into resulting atomic physics Hamiltonian. Because at this point, if I know what the Hamiltonian is, we can calculate specifically for this particular atom how large is the effect, whatever that is. Because we can, we have a handle atomic wave functions. Then the next question, okay, how does experimental signal looks like? And how to assess possible systematics effects, which are just standard models, say your electric, magnetic fields, and so on. Then you need to analyze the experiment in terms of the BSM physics. Usually you do need AMO theory for that, because you still need to calculate whatever matrix elements of the Hamiltonian is. And then it would be nice also to feedback the understanding of experimental capabilities for future ideas to high energy theory. And then also to analyze. So we've done the experiment. What did we learn in this case? One thing which I would like to warn you, atomic experiment doesn't quite still on board with the idea that we are just ruling out the parameter space. This is quite alien for the way atomic physics actually works. In many cases, it's like we have this effect, we understand that to the level of, say, a few percent, and maybe even sub percent, or we understand it quantitatively, and then we move on to something, to some other effects. So parameter space, there have been papers, atomic physics papers, with parameter space plots in the past 5 years, but this is new to us. What? Well, so it's not that bad. Okay, it's not EDMs, that bad. Right, but for, so EDMs, but okay, I'll actually talk. So I agree, but when we talk about EDM, but there is a beautiful, essentially, graph which saying, okay, if you don't see EDM here, then you rule out some part of a supersymmetry, and I'll show you that plot. So EDM has also been a special case, and yes, there is a number of parameter plot, but parameter plots of multiple parameter plots, interaction strengths versus mass, this is something relatively still new. But thank you, yes, I agree. So, ideas, how to promote this. So now I will open for a bit of a discussion, since I've been talking for some time.
So when you, I mean, for AMO Hamiltonian, do you need a coupling from some new particle to neutrons.
Right, so pretty much as long as I have your Lagrangian,
yeah,
I can probably reasonably try to reduce it. And Andrei will actually have special slides about this. I will show for Lorentz symmetry how that's done.
About how to talk to an atomic physicist.
Yeah. If you don't understand natural units very well, let's put it this way. I do have now collaboration with particle physics looking for relaxions, and I'm very much surprised to find that everything is measured in inverse electron volts. So electron volts or inverse electron volts, okay. So which was news to me, but you know, I sat down through the natural units. I mean, but I live in a world of atomic units. In my case, H bar is 1, E is 1, mass of electron is 1, but C is not 1.
E is 1.
E is 1, and mass of electron is 1, and H bar is 1. Well, it's E divided by a square root of, you know, 4 pi epsilon 0, right? And again, we can talk about whether there is an SI version and not SI version of this, and, you know, we stepped on some of the hidden stones there before.
So, the gist is that you basically need to do non-physicalistic corrections in your Hamiltonian in order to be appreciated and understood right by experimental community.
So, but in general, this is absolutely the minimum thing which is needed, how actually whatever you have couples to a standard model. And from that point on, again, with some difficulties, a lot of those things already had been reduced to various Hamiltonians. So sometimes, for example, we can track, for example, if it's a scalar particle with or, you know, without CP violation, we know, we technically know how it couples. But this part, we generally, it's something which would nice to have a help with. And for a lot of things, it had been done. For many things, it have not been done.
In some sense, my very crude appreciation of what AMO can offer is that generally speaking, from the BSM perspective, they're all sensitive to effects of light, degrees of freedom, so somewhat long-range forces, things like that. And so then it's just a list, right? Then it's, is it a scalar, a pseudoscalar, a vector? Is it coupled to, you know, electrons, gluons? I mean, there's like a table that we can calculate, right, and check all of the, make a map from each of those entries in the table to AMI Hamiltonians, and then we would be done, right?
Well, but then the next question is that it has to be reduced to experimental signal. And the next question, is that a frequency measurement? Is that a spin precession measurement? Is it best to do it with interferometry? And what generally people understand under interferometry, there are a lot of frequency measurements which actually done as phase measurements, which are not quite. So I think this is one of the issues that which I'll talk about. All the BSM physics AMO measurements are kind of separated. I'm measuring this because people measured that before. Like, for example, with EDM, we understood what to measure it, how to measure it better. But then, for example, you have a test of equivalence principle, which are all general analyzers Edwards ratio. How to recalculate that back into your specific dark matter theory, that's something which is absolutely not trivial for us. So recalculating completely different things. For example, variation of fundamental constants now can be interpreted as a dark matter signal. The variation, violation of Lorentz invariance also can be tracked back to some of the extra forces and so on. And this is not something which is actually being done completely. And in many cases, there is no feedback. If something is measured, there's not quite feedback into the main parameter space programs which designed by the theory. So, what are the advantages of searching for the BSM physics? The great thing, the experiments are tabletop. When I say tabletop, it's usually like a few tables top, because that's approximately how the table looks like. This is a clock. This is a strontium clock. Usually they will have a few setups additional, which makes lasers, which makes frequency comps and so on. But the main idea, this is something which can be built in the university lab by a single investigator with a group or by a number of principal investigators.
So, by the way, the price of that clock, I would estimate it about $1 million.
Yeah, okay? Maybe more.
So this is startup, basically, right? So it's not...
Maybe this one is more expensive, actually.
Oh, well, but there was no sense.
This is Jilla, this is a Julius Strunzio.
So compared to the LHC, for example, right?
Yeah.
Because of the LHC, this is really, really minor.
I mean, are there any contexts where multiplexing or scaling up of this is useful, like for a DOE stage one large scale experiment, you could buy 1,000 of these. Would that ever be a good idea?
So the sensitivity is going to go the square root of n of the number of devices?
I think there's a certain value things, none of this would be worth it. But the only question is are there any effects that don't just go like statistics or anything? Is there any scenario? This is just something to keep in the back of.
Well, I think the cases where, and I'll show more about the funding issue, when this is what would be needed, for example, building a completely new EDM experiment, that would be at least $several million. This is generally outside of what can be funded by the NSF. And I'll talk actually about that as well. So the other thing, which is something which is very different from high energy physics, that all of those atomic clocks, atomic interferometers, atomic magnetometers are being built completely independently of the entire effort to search for the beyond the standard model physics. They're built for other reasons, and they're funded, the building of the setups themselves are funded by, the Defense Department and other agencies which actually are not searching for dark matter as their primary objective. So in this case, the important part that this will continue and there is a very quick progress because there is a lot of extremely smart people working on how to actually improve those devices. Then in some cases, not all of them, experiments can actually be done quickly because the existing setup already, exists. For example, there was a quantum information group in Berkeley, where Dima Butker was, and they talked about how to do the test of Lorentz symmetry, and they actually were able to do it with quantum formation techniques in 3 months, improving limits by a factor of 100. So in some cases, of course, those are dedicated multi-year experiments. Some things actually propagated for decades, like France impurity violation measurement. I still was a graduate student when it was ongoing, and they moved from Stony Brook to Triumph. Eventually it will be done, but those things take a long time. But for the most part, a lot of experiments done relatively quickly. And as I mentioned, the experimental techniques are very rapidly evolving because they're strongly driven by other applications, and we already have an idea how to improve pretty much at all fronts. So there will be a very significant improvement within the next 20 years. So it'd be very nice to sort of forward all that effort toward also testing the BSM physics as well. The other thing which many people don't realize, AMO field's strongly growing. So it like our meeting grew since I was from graduate students to now, about 600 people to about 1,300. So we're about half students. So all those students and then the postdocs who are actually looking for new projects as a faculty, not all of them want to build quantum computers. And then there is a much interest and a willingness in the community to do BSM physics research, even for people who are not really, who've never heard of those things, but they actually very, very much like talking to us, and essentially I'm asked by people, what can we do? For example, I'm invited the next week to go give a talk at Livermore National Lab, and this is a community which absolutely has nothing with BSM physics searches, and they're not EBIT high energy, you know, the are people who do those highly charged ions and QED. Those are people who do high intensity lasers, and they ask, okay, what do you want me to talk about? Because, you know, I've talked about the super heavy systems and actinides and something which is totally unrelated to this. And they said, oh, could you give a status of the dark matter, those dark matter searches? If any of them uses lasers, it would be even great. So, okay, you know, they actually, if you tell them which experiment to do, they probably can actually do it. And this is very different, I think, from the way some of the other BSM physics searches are done. So you do have sort of untapped resource in the community who is happy to implement the ideas. So what is the, you know, one of the main motivators for the precision physics is that precision devices, for example, clocks, got so precise. You're talking about 10 to the minus 18 fractional precision, so it's 18 significant figures. That it's quite possible that some of the unknown physics can actually show up as a systematics in the experiment. For example, it's quite possible that fundamental constants may vary at this point, at the limit which would be detectable. And in this case, in terms of experiments, yes, you do have specific dedicated experiments like the EDM, but you also have a lot of precision data, and the new effort now led by Dima Butkir and, you know, Andrei here, is to have all the data time-stamped, because then you can actually look for the transient effects, for example, for topological dark matter sweeping through, which will desynchronize precision devices throughout the world. In many cases, data already exists, and in many cases, some minimal modification of the setup will lead to the new precision experiments for the BSM, specific aimed at BSM physics. And as I mentioned, people are willing to do it. Also, there is generally a very strong coupling of AMO theory to AMO experiments, so we generally understand how those work. And one of the reasons why it's specifically coupled for the BSM physics, it's because the theory will provide new ideas, so we'll propose new experiments, and very important part, there are a lot of atoms, and there are even more ions. So the question which we theorists can answer, if you want to see the largest signal, what system you should be using? And this is the type of questions which we can answer. So then you need to calculate the properties of the system. For example, the first question when I talk to experimentalists proposing a new experiment is, what is the wavelengths? Like, which laser should I buy? And that's one of the really important cases which we can answer. And then experiments will have to be analyzed to extract new physics. And then one need to propose new tools for the precision measurement. For example, building now the nuclear clocks, building clocks with highly charged ions, how to laser cool molecules, which will then feed back into new generational experiments. So the challenges which we have, first is lack of actually connection back to the high energy theory. Then the next question is, those experiments essentially measuring zero. And this is something which would have to be addressed. If the result is negative, and it's great if something is found, and we actually very much hope it will be, but if the result is negative, what actually had been achieved? And when I talk to my experimental colleagues, essentially the main question is, okay, I measured my Lorentz invariance to say 10 to the minus 20. Did I rule out some theory? And the main answer is no. Unfortunately, there is, in many cases, there is not even direct connection between specific theories, especially anything dealing with string theories, into measurable signals. And in this case, yes, we do deal with the reducing parameter space, and I think it's become more and more understandable for my experimental colleagues, but having a very strong connection between types of theories and then what is actually measured, this is what we need. And I'll show the example of this. And then the entire experimental effort is divided by some of the interpretations. For example, I'm measuring the equivalence principle violation, you're measuring violation of Lorentz invariance, and somebody measuring variation of fundamental constants. Honestly, all of those can be interpreted as dark matter extra force searches. But we need to understand how to do it or how to cross-interpret the experiment. And then, of course, there's a funding dilemma because there is no precision frontier for the DOE high energy program. So most experiments are funded either by NSF, by searches which, by sources which have absolutely nothing to do with BSM physics, or with private foundation money like Simon's.
I should have asked this before, but isn't there an opportunity here for us to hijack the whatever the quantum information initiative from DOE, which has a quantum sensor component?
Yes, I'm funded for developing of clocks, and for quantum information, and for development of community of, you know, community codes, etc., etc. So, and yes, of course there is NSF, but when I talk, for example, to people and ask, well, so we have the quantum initiative. If I'm using quantum physics to measure, you know, to search for dark matter, from their point of view, that's stretching it a bit too far. So I specifically, there is a new quantum initiative in NSF, and I've sort of been told that this is a bit too far. So all the divisions can interpret it as any way they want. But nevertheless, this is, the DOE had been a problem. In this case, I know because the ACME experiment for measuring EDM, which is, you know, exactly was searching essentially for signals which are similar to supersymmetry, was not funded by the DOE high energy. They have actually tried. They have letters from a lot of people that did not work. So the question is going to be next generation of new experiments, which are going to be more expensive. And the entire amount of EMO experimental program at NSF, it's about $30 million per year. And that's everyone. So the question is, why now? So why it's now is particularly a great time to actually use EMO experiments for the BSM physics searches. Well, first, because atoms are now cold and trapped and just sitting there in very nice potentials. It's essentially very hard to do precision measurement when things actually, all your atoms and ions, whatever you have, are moving around, and when you have no degree of control of your systems. So in this point, essentially all the ions or atoms are trapped in the potentials, which you can do, those are counterpropagating laser beams. And you can build one-dimensional traps, two-dimensional traps, or three-dimensional traps, and you're putting neutral atoms, or just one neutral atom, in each one of those, this eggshell-type potential. So essentially, you hold artificial crystal by light, and in this case, this is an extremely perfectly controllable system. So you understand also atom-light interactions extremely well. So you actually have a very good theoretical description of the system. For ions, you can actually either put one ion in a trap, or this is literally ion chains, and you can actually access individual ions. So this is why precision measurements improved so much in the past 10 years, just because we have those technologies. And the other things, they've been method designed how to measure optical frequencies, because if you'd like to measure, to build atomic clock, so what you actually need to do, you need to be able to measure the frequency to extreme precision. And normal electronic counters can only count at about 10 to the 10 hertz. So you can do the cesium clock, but you cannot do 10 to the 15 hertz, which you need for the optical frequencies. So people have invented how to actually connect between optical frequency and microwave frequencies. And now you can actually design the frequency. So you can probe at whatever frequency you want at this point. And this also has been extended to UV. And that's actually been a great, absolutely great improvement in terms of how you can measure frequencies to extreme precision.
Quantitatively, what is the frequency range and what is the limit?
Well, okay. So if you're talking about just precision measurements, so you need to measure frequency, I think you can actually get frequency comes down to 10 nanometers. So those are very, I mean, you will get very few energy. So, but we are talking about 10 to 40 nanometers and so on. The optical range, when you talk about 300 to 800 nanometers, that's something which people have been doing for 15 years or so.
But it's also pushing into the mid-IR.
Yes, it's also going to infrared, so you can actually get all the way to, you know, over 2,000 nanometers or so. So there's a very wide range, and you literally can actually, this apparatus will allow you to compare two frequencies independently of the frequency standards. So you actually beat two of the waves against each other. So you can actually compare things without actually ever comparing to the cesium standard. That's why you can actually do frequency measurements which are better than what cesium clock, which our 1 second can actually do.
Can you say how that works?
Okay. It's best if I actually show. Let me see if I can find it. See if I have it on this one. Yes. Okay. So here is this work. So first, the basic idea, you're converting from time domain to frequency domain. So you have a laser which sends a pulse signal. And the duration of the signal, we are talking about the femtosecond pulse. And this signal then is phase shifted just a little bit, but the phase shift is always the same. So you have pulses going in time domain. Then all you have to do, you essentially convert it to the frequency domain, you just do Fourier transform. And now this becomes this, and this is what the frequency comp actually is. It produces potential signals at all possible frequencies. So those are different frequencies, and those are separated by the repetition frequency. So the duration between the pulses, it's a difference between those two teeth. So the main question, why people haven't done it longer time ago, that they couldn't measure what the offset frequency is. And what they've actually done is they were able to create a comp from this point to this point, you exactly double the frequency. So you actually measure exactly what this offset is. So you measure the offset, what the repetition frequency is. It's some sort of microwave frequency. So you know exactly what the optical frequency is and you can measure it. Andrei, what do you add something?
So you could look at this, the collection of lasers. So instead of one pulse laser, you get
lasers at all of those frequencies at the same time.
This huge collection of lasers, right, and then they are all phase locked in respect to each other. So you could beat your frequencies against those lasers, right?
But the main idea is that now this is optical frequency, but both of those things are microwave. In microwave, you can count as normal counters. So, and then you know what the n is in this case. And let's say you have one clock with frequency somewhere here, another clock with frequency somewhere there. All you do, you just send the signal, both of the signals, into the frequency comp, and you just measure the bit node, and essentially it tells you what the frequency ratio is of those two things without ever comparing to actually any standard. And in this case, they can do those teeth, all the way down from VUV into the microwave. So imagine now, instead of one laser, you have many, many, many lasers, all phase locks, and they're all separated by some microwave frequency.
So this is what the best clocks are based on?
This is how you actually count the frequency of the clock. Because somehow what you do, you shine a laser into your atoms. Atoms make transition. Then you lock it when transition, and I'll show it. At some point when the probability of transition becomes maximum, all the atoms make the transition. You lock your laser, but then you have to count what is the frequency of your laser. And this is counted by this. So essentially because you need to know where exactly did you actually end up.
So the problem is that the electronic counters, they only work at at microwaves, right? So at the gigahertz rate, for example, right? So, but they cannot count these optical cycles, right? So then you have to down convert them, and that is done with the pulses. The beauty of this work is that before the frequency comp, these lasers that used to down convert and all of this equipment, it was like at least it was occupying
unsupportable.
The entire floor almost. Okay, so and this guy just. Small box.
It's a commercially available system. You can just buy one. You don't need to build one anymore. So, the things which are like 40 nanometers, that's something which is state of the art. Maybe a few places have it, but this is something which people can buy.
So, an optical frequency, how well can it be measured?
18 significant figures. So, the best clocks are 18 significant figures. 2 to the 18 and so on.
So that's like,
but this is not absolute frequency measure. What we are saying, you can actually compare it to frequencies to 10 to the minus 18. Because to make an absolute frequency measure, you have to measure it against 1 second standard, which is 10 to the minus 16. It's the best clocks can do. Which will change, actually. So eventually, some other standard based on things like this. Oops, sorry about that. So I think when I switch between different talks, it goes into the different mode. So let's go back to this talk. The switch. Yep. Okay. And the other thing, and this is, I think, have not really been fully explored by the beyond the standard model of physics research, it's the ability of a quantum control. So what you can do is not only that you can actually excite specific ion or atom into a specific quantum state, you can build superpositions of those atoms. And quantum formation, what they do for a living, they protect those quantum bits, those states of atoms, against different external perturbations. For example, against magnetic field. There's no how to do it. So this is one of the resources to use in the physics beyond the standard model searches, because this essentially cancels some of the main noise effects. And in this case, it's been used in a few experiments very recently, but again, this is one of those some top potential.
What is the sort of time scale that you could prepare systems that's stable against decoherence just for you?
Well, I mean, the preparation time is generally milliseconds kind of things. Oh, I think it's 60 seconds coherence. I think
that's
what
the time for it to be
coherent. Right, so I think the best quantum information would be 30 to 60 seconds. I forgot what exactly it would be. Right.
So people ask a more general question. For how long a trapped particle will stay trapped, right?
Forever.
Jerry Gabrielsi, in his lab, they even name their trapped electrons. You know, this is an electron they live for that long, you know, so months and months.
Right? I mean, the thing you would imagine doing is making use of the long coherence times, right?
Yeah.
Well,
as I said, for example, such superposition, when you have two ions and you maintain superposition of two different states, so both of the ions can be either in this state or both of the ions can be in this state, you have 50-50% possibility. I think what we quoted, my experimental colleagues told me, the best state of the art was about a million or so. So again, if you have more than two, then it gets more complicated, but nevertheless, this is something which is a great resource.
And what's the oscillation time between these two states?
The Rabi oscillations, I think that was, the probe time was milliseconds. Am I right here? Or?
Yeah,
something like this.
Factors like 10 to the 4, or
10 to the 5. No, this is not quite. It's
the optical.
So this is a microwave transition. That's why it's a bit of a different scale. So that depends, I think, very specifically on exactly what you're trying to do there. So
between two hyperfine.
This is Zeeman. So, but that was a one specific experiment. Actually, show how this experiment works.
So the splitting's in the microwave.
The splitting, yes, somewhere in there for that particular case. But you could do optical as well. So you can actually perfectly have control of superposition of optical states.
And still remain coherent, though,
isn't it? Well, for optical states, it's probably what they have. For the optical states, the problem is not your system, it's your laser. So the laser, I think, the best record is the laser wave will remain coherent for 55 seconds for strontium clock. So which is many, many times going back and forth to the moon. So it's how much time laser remains actually in phase, because you're always interrogating by the laser. So it's not actually limited by the atoms, it's limited by the laser at this point.
Nathaniel, how could you use coherence to what do you imagine?
You imagine you prepare imagine there's something that interacts with the state, something, I don't know, a couple of time variation that leads to that if you protect against all other decoherent effects in your apparatus, you would actually be sensitive to, for example, you're trying to just use anything that would, any external impact on the quantum coherence would stay apart from the normal scanning. That's the kind of thing.
Andrew will actually talk about this specifically as applied to dark matter searches next time. But the main idea, think about is the following. Let's say now you lose coherence and you have to repeat the measurements. When you repeat the measurements, your scaling is square root of n. when you actually remain coherent, your scaling is n with your number of particles which you're using. So it's a very different scaling law, so you actually gain enormously.
Well
no, not quite. Okay, there are caveats. Okay.
These states are highly fragile. So if you destroy, say, so if you perturb, for example, just one state, just one ion, this entire
things goes away.
Right. This entire,
but for clocks, right. That's a different point there. So. Okay. So as a result, because of those technologies, what atomic physics have done for the past 20 years, and at this point, these are, all of these are mature technologies, the development of clocks, interferometers, and magnetometers improved, the clocks improved from, by maybe as much as 8 orders of magnitude in 20 years and so going, but now going to completely a different regime from microwave frequencies to the optical frequencies. Optical clocks did not exist that far back even, because you could measure the frequencies. And then now, instead of just having light interferometers, you actually can use meta waves as interferometers, and I'll show how that works. And in this case, you separate the clouds of atoms and recombine them afterwards. Instead of having laser beams actually separate and recombine, you actually have sensitivity to completely different classes of effects doing it this way. Magnetometers measure the magnetic field to extreme precision. We are talking about better than, you know, billions of fraction magnetic field of Earth. And then other things which you can use, as I mentioned, ultra-cold entrapped atoms and ions, so-called molecular beams now used for the EDM, and the quantum information technologies. And then the list is going on. So those things are in progress. For example, now you can cool highly charged ions when you tear away a lot of electrons. And this gives you specific advantages of accessing very relativistic electrons, for example. And like Lorentz invariance and the alpha variation would actually scale with the kinetic or potential energy of your electron in your system. So the effects are getting enhanced in this case, relativistically, or any of the QED type effects. Then, as I mentioned, there are UV frequency comps, and the progress is laser cooling of molecules, because this will give you extreme push to the complete, actually different systems. Unfortunately, it's very hard to laser cool molecules because there are rotational states, vibrational states, other states. So you try to laser cool it, meaning you actually go up and down and the thing cools, so you need to close the cycle. In molecules, as soon as you excite something, it distributes over hundreds of levels and try to collect it back. So it's very hard to close cooling cycles on molecules, but there are specific molecules where people know it's possible to do it, and people already have proposals how to do EDMs 4 orders of magnitude better with those.
With existing technologies?
With existing technologies, right. So the, this is almost the laser cooling of molecules. There have been a proof of principle demonstrations, but not in systems specifically useful for fundamental physics tests. The next generation would be to do it in actual systems we actually need to. Because in this case, all the technologies which you can use for atoms, you can use for molecules. If you could have molecules in those, sitting on those lattices, that would be great. So it will be done, and there is, and again, people are doing it for completely different reasons than searching for dark matter again.
From the AMO point of view, why are the highly charged ions?
It's a relativistic enhancement, and also, again, in terms of building clocks, so now, instead of this electron cloud, you have this electron cloud. It's much harder to perturb by all electric fields. Because the imagine you have a neutral system, so your Z is matched by electrons and the nuclei. And now you start tearing away electrons, so you still have a Z charge for the nuclei, but Z minus N charge for the electrons. So the nuclei attracts electron more, the cloud shrinks. And it shrinks by a lot. It shrinks from, say, 20 atomic units to less than 1 atomic unit. The tighter the cloud, the harder it is to perturb by electric fields. It's a basic idea. So all the moments, magnetic, electric moments, quadrupole moments, are smaller. So technically, you can build better clocks. But this is a completely separate branch from atomic physics, which separated from ultra-cold physics, you know, 25 years ago. And we are trying to bring them back. So essentially, also those have to be produced by specific devices, but now you can actually have like a small thing graduate student can build, how to make those.
Basically how to make clocks about 3-4 hours or something better compared to what we have now. So it is in the cards.
Also, for example, the highly charged ions have transitions which are in completely different range. They're actually in the X-ray. So, for example, with those type of trapped ions, they can actually calibrate synchrotron radiation, for example. So we are talking a completely different region. So clocks, they're still going to be in optical, or because we don't have lasers in that range, at least you're not usable lasers for clock, but this can actually shift more to the UV. There are all technical reasons why the clocks are based on optical transitions, like visible, mostly visible transition. It's because mostly your optics essentially being destroyed by the UV radiation at about 120 nanometers or so. So it's also, it's much harder to build lasers for those systems. But then for you talk about synchrotron radiation and other things which are not perfectly controlled, there are applications of highly charged ions people want them for, which have nothing to do with this. Also, astrophysics wants precision measurement for the highly charged ions because that's what you see in space. So, and if you, the thing is trapped, it means there is no Doppler shift. It's very highly controlled. The less Doppler shift, the more precisely you can measure frequencies, the more precisely you can compare with astrophysics sources. Which also is, I mean, that's another point, how to measure things coming from absorption equation lines accurately. That's a totally different idea.
So if you have many charged ions, then you have Coulomb repulsion.
Right. For now, let's think about exactly one ion, because all the trapped ion clocks, it's a single ion, which is actually quite interesting. When I talk in front of nuclear physics colleagues, they think, oh, but what if you have different isotopes? You know, there your clocks will be different frequencies. Like, okay, we have exactly one ion. So, and there are ideas how to do multiple chain ions because that limits your stability, but it's a different problem. So, but it sits further away. Right. So the highly charged ion, yes, the Coulomb, but Coulomb repulsion would actually push it further away, which is better, because then you can control the lasers by not overlapping beams. And actually, for quantum formation, you can run gates, quantum gates much faster. So, but I'm still convincing quantum formation people that highly charged ions are interesting. So, okay, but this will be done, and essentially those things will be continued, and this is a great resource for your community, which are new tools for the precision measurements. The other thing which I haven't mentioned, there is also the whole completely different effort of ultra strong and ultra fast lasers. And this is completely decoupled, with the exception of light shining through the wall, which is not quite that, completely decoupled from the BSM physics. So if anyone has ideas how, for example, produce, say, you know, dark photons by high-intensity lasers, that would be something which people, I think, if some measurable effect can be observed for the dark matter coupling from high-intensity lasers, that's actually something which people would probably be able to do eventually. Okay, so I will show just three slides from clocks, and Andrei will talk more about it. So how does a basic clock work? So first, clock itself consists of three parts. So first, you have your atom, and it can be one ion or it can be many atoms. So this is your clock transition. So the basic idea, when you shine your laser, the atoms will transition from level one to level two. The closer to this atomic resonance, this is how atomic resonance looks like, it's a line shape. This is your perfect transition frequency for your laser. The closer your laser to this perfect atomic frequency, atomic reference, the more atom transition from one to two. And what you actually measure, it's how many atoms are in state two and how many atoms are in state one. So if you find now that you achieve perfectly your the perfect excitation with 50-50, if you achieve that, then okay, that's my right laser wavelength, which is perfectly aligned with the transition. You lock the laser because you there is a feedback control. If you can shift it a little bit and see how many, what's the population of atoms, you shift a little bit more, see if it's more or less. And as soon as you think you actually achieved the perfect resonance, you lock your laser at this frequency and you measure what the wavelength was of the frequency comp. So this is how atomic clock basically works. You can also have two clocks. No, this is your laser. So what this laser does, it transitions for all purposes, you assume all atoms are in here in ground state. They actually build cooled and trapped. So they're sitting already in atomic trap, they're already in the ground state of everything. So the all atoms in the ground state, you shine your laser, and what it does, it actually makes a Rabi oscillation. So the atoms will oscillate between state one and two. So as soon as you reach the maximum amplitude of the oscillations, which you can, this is your correct frequency. So the point...
how do you measure...
Oh, can I, is there a, so one thing you can do, it's couple, so you actually have state one in state 2. You shine an ISA laser, which can only couple those states and then see fluorescence from this transition. So this is one of the techniques which you can do. There are some other more direct techniques, but this is a basic idea. This state will look dark. This state does not look dark. You just actually look for image on the CCD camera. So this is one of the things which can be done. I mean, other things can be done as well. So, and this can be done essentially perfectly. So it's 99.999% accurate in this case. Other questions? So this technology will be discussed more next Wednesday. What does it give you? It gives you ability to measure frequency to 18 significant figures. So the clock which people have will not lose 1 second in the lifetime of the universe here at this point. So any effect which can be expressed in terms of variation of frequency, that's what you can measure with atomic clock. So for example, if you have a dark matter which can be described as some sort of a classical wave, and all ultralight dark matter can be. In this case, all of your frequencies will also start slightly oscillating. And you can actually get that effect and extract the mass for your dark matter. The next thing is atom interferometers. And the basic idea here is that you have atomic beam, so you have atom, again, very cold atoms. You split the beam in two parts, and then you recombine the beam, and you look at the phase difference. So if those two things evolved differently, because, for example, you have some, you know, space-time fluctuation, people actually have set limits for that as well. Or, for example, you put a mass here, and people put limits on chameleon effects this way. Then your phases will be slightly different, and you measure different in phases. You have analyzing with the fringe of your interferometer, and from that signal, you can extract whether this pass and this pass varied due to some beyond the standard model effect. This is also the proposal how to search for gravitational waves with atoms, even though this is much more complicated and probably eventually will have to be in space. At this point, the ideas for the atom interferometry was sort of assuming for some of the next generation development, which is quite reasonable and possible, are comparable with laser interferometry with LISA proposal. So you can actually have those atom interferometers in space separated by a million kilometers, and you interrogate those. Yes?
What's the total area?
Okay, so the state of the, it's very much different. What is it for? There are small cavity things. The entire thing is actually an optical cavity, for example, for those chameleon searches. But the largest thing, you're talking about 10 meters of the actually how the clouds fall and a half a meter separation between clouds. So this is a microscopic separation.
I see, so they're moved apart by half a meter?
You can move them apart to half a meter and then recombine them after 10 meters and they still remain quantum. I would like to impress upon you. You actually impart, I think, 90 recoil units or 90 recoil photons, so which are absorbed, to actually separate them that far. So the more photons is being absorbed, the further you can separate them. So it's a basic idea.
So there is a proposal for 100 meter interferometer. I think it is has a thermal lab. So
I see that in the
So these interferometers, so it's Mark
Kasevich.
Kasevich, right. So this is done in a function geometry. So you are shooting atoms up, right? And then you are manipulating the internal states and giving the kicks. So the clouds separate by about half a meter, but the entire fountain is so. So it is just an inch as well, not just, but it's kind of the three-story type of a fountain. And they are thinking about 100 meter interferometer.
Like the 100 meters is the 100 meter.
Right.
Literally.
It is the fountain, right? Yeah.
Now, Kasevich, this experiment already happened.
Kasevich, yes, this is his recent.
He measured a phase that he wanted to call due to the difference in the gravitational potential, but was he able to actually show, lots of things that could induce phases, yeah.
Okay, well, that was actually, the half a meter separation thing, that was, I think, just a show step of, state of the art. This is, you actually do still see the fringes. So the thing remains still quantum. And we are talking about, the millions of atoms, and they eventually would need like 10 to the 8 of atoms or so. But what people have successfully done, they've built gravimeters out of this. So you can actually measure G to extreme precision with it, small g, right. To the point that I believe they can measure if, for example, the truck passes by and there is something inside the truck that actually would produce sufficient shift for that to be measured. And there is also somewhat different between, technically you can actually use clocks to actually as some sort of gravimeter. So when you differ the clock from one clock to another by 1 centimeter, what do you think the shift of frequency is? So let's say you have a clock on a table. You raise the table by 1 centimeter. How much the clock frequency will change? Take a guess. What?
Centimeter
divided by radius of the Earth. Times 10^-18. So with a clock with 10^-18 accuracy, you can actually measure shift gravitational potential to 1 centimeter. So the one of the application of those clocks is to measure the Earth's geode. So those clocks will be built. In fact, Japan, I've actually seen in those errata meetings, they're actually literally thinking surrounding Japan entirely by those little clocks, which essentially be dropped into the ocean and will report essentially how the ocean floor moves. They're actually hoping to predict earthquakes with this. Unfortunately, there is really no idea of actually any model how the floor lifts and what actually happens afterwards. But there have been detection of that the floor, you know, the ocean floor lifts a little bit before some of the earthquakes. But the point is, what the clocks will actually measure is just how much the ground shifted. And the other thing, which is actually, at this point, clocks are sensitive enough to see if the magma chambers in the volcano fill as long as it's about, I think, 1 cubic kilometer. So there is sufficient difference in the potential that you actually have clocks around that they will see the differential. Okay, minus all the problems of comparing different clocks, et cetera, but this will become possible. There is actually a recent review on using clocks for geodesy on the archive.
And what's the accuracy on the phase?
I think it just depends on what interferometer you have. I think it's very hard. Okay. So in
times fraction of 2 pi, right?
So no, we are talking about.
For some reason, the number 10^-9
comes. Yeah.
Comes inside. I don't remember that. What also happens here is that in atomic physics there is a huge flow of atoms, right, and they accumulate this enormous statistics, right? So it's actually after averaging, right? So by the way, so the LHC, how many grams of protons?
Protons they are actually. I'm curious.
Right,
about a nanogram.
Right? Okay. A typical atomic experiment in cesium takes about 1 kilogram. Okay? So it's also this statistics that
But the main idea, you can actually, if your whatever BSM model effects is different for a different pass, that's a way to measure it. In many cases, the actual frequency measurement are done through the phase measurements. For example, as long as you can actually, even the EDM, as long as you actually split your atomic clouds in two different states and then recombine, you look actually at the phase, and phase gives you the energy difference. So they're not exactly interferometer experiments, but they are still using the phase as a measurement techniques. So basically, you can measure phase due to your effect to very high precision. Then the other thing, it's atomic magnetometers, and the basic idea to use atoms themselves to measure the magnetic field, so essentially you can measure spin precession very, very accurately. So any kind of things, for example, axions, which causing some sort of small changes in magnetic fields, then you can use it actually to hunt for those things. And some of the variants of Casper, not the electric one, but the other one, actually it's something which you actually want. In many, many different systems, most of the atomic searches for extra forces are done with magnetometry. A lot of Lorentz invariance tests are done with magnetometry because those will have effects on spin precession. So those are kind of, those three are very basic tools. You also have things which are not related to those three measurements when you essentially do some sort of a very precision spectroscopy measurement, either with trap systems or with cold beams. And I will speak in some more detail about which of the measurements are actually done in which way. Because there are so many things which have been done, but in many cases, a lot of groups are not really talking much to each other, and it was not actually clear even initially what the size of this whole effort was. So we decided to write a review and try to really survey the entire effort of search for new physics with atoms and molecules. This is not historical review, it's essentially what has been done in, say, past 10 years, and what are the future proposals. If anyone had difficulty loading it, I think there was a problem with accessing archives 2 days ago. I think it should be okay now. So if anyone actually has problem accessing it, let me know. I can just send you the file. So we do have our experimental colleagues and also Charles Clark, our theory colleague. And between us, we mostly have all the expertise for all of the fields. We have decided that it's going to be reviewed really, literally all types of searches beyond the standard model of physics, which are done with atoms and molecules. So I very briefly actually go through the chapters, and the ones which underlined will be reviewed in some more details by Isomir here, if you have time, or by Andre next week. And I would like to separate by types of the specific experiment and what tools I actually have been used to search for those. And that goes as the chapters of the review go. For first, there is a monumental effort to search for variation of fundamental constants. Most of those things are done with clocks or with some precision spectroscopy measurements not involving clocks. Then, of course, this whole effort started with astrophysicists claiming they've seen 4 sigma variation of alpha going from absorption spectra of distant quasars. This result did not quite go away, but they've been detected the calibration problems, which are both short-term drifts and long-term drifts at about 10 to the minus 5 level at both CAC and VLT telescopes. They are installing, I think VLT already installed the new spectrographs, which are high resolution. Those things actually are not linked to the optical frequency comps yet. So there are some first measurements, but all the tungsten lamps, which I actually was surprised to find. So the new things, some of the newer technologies would be actually referencing those spectrometers into the optical frequency comps. So Andre will probably talk more about this effort, and specifically how to do it with clocks. So when there is a claim that alpha actually varies in time, the good thing to see if the alpha actually varies now, and that's what the clocks do. But the point is, the clocks do it anyway. The clocks do measurements of the frequencies and referring one clock to each other as a normal operation of the clock. And this automatically gives you some of the constraints on the BSM physics. And then the new ideas is how to actually use it to do dark matter searches. Test of QED has probably been...
This review also has a chapter on ultralight dark matter.
It's on the next page. There is a next page. There is a next page, yes. Okay. So yeah, I've run through all the chapters here. So now, precision test of QED actually done in completely different ways. There are some with Halley-Chastain, some with hydrogen, some with helium, some with exotic atoms, muonic hydrogen, for example, et cetera, et cetera. So there is a discrepancy which is not understood here. So there's several sigma discrepancy which existed now for several years, which we do not understand, which is called the proton radius puzzle, pretty much which is saying if you measure the proton radius using muons or electrons, you get quite different result. Which is, as of now, there is no explanation why it's happening. Unfortunately, 2 new measurements just made it worse. So honestly, I thought it was just an experimental problem. That didn't happen to be so. It's probably still an experimental problem, but nevertheless. It looks like, in muons, in electrons, protons don't look the same, which we don't understand why that's so.
Systematics are there? Like
well, everything had been redone, and those groups really know what they're doing. So the systematics, understand, this is a spectroscopy measurement. This is measuring frequencies. People measure those frequencies now precision for more than 20 years. And all the new systematics which come up because we have new technologies, for example, quantum interference between different levels, had been actually accounted for. So it's conceivable there is something else which you don't understand, but on its own, this is, people have spent years trying to do it very accurately at this point.
So one of the problems with these precision measurements, you have a line shape, right? And typically the line shape is...
This is called a line shape. So that thing is called a line shape.
So...
of your resonance, sorry.
You expect the muon to the second level and it comes back down.
I will show. Actually, I have the slides.
For example, if you have a beam of hydrogen atoms, right, there is a Doppler shift on top of the There is also the laser itself, if you shine it on transition, it induces perturbations. And the line, this head line, that beautiful line over there, it's not beautiful.
Not what they see.
So, and then the problem is,
this is already
how you. Okay, fine.
I'm asking. This is
It looks as a normal case. Well, is it?
But for muons,
okay,
it, it's four line shapes away. So the muonic line shape, the resonance, it's four widths away. So it's really four.
Do you remember how big the effect?
I will actually have slides specifically about this. So if you actually, yeah. So effect is okay. Okay. Let me. Well, okay. We'll get to that. I'll show you. It's. Well, we are talking about in terms of uncertainty of muonic experiments. We are talking about more than 100 sigma. In terms of the hydrogen, we are talking about 4 to 7 sigma, depending on how you're comparing. In terms of individual measurements, that's less. So it's not an easy question to answer, but I'll show the graph. So then you have atomic parity violation. Andrei will mention that because this is one of the ways to look for dark Z, because this is uniquely sensitive to abnormal, you know, extra Z bosons of various kinds. And the atomic parity violation sits at about, 30 MeV. So it's the only thing which will be sensitive to dark bosons, you know, under about 100 MeV range, or 200 MeV range. So, and then EDM, which I'll talk about, here are the techniques. So actually, atomic parity violation all have been done so far with beam experiments, and there are new called trapped atom or ion experiments. You all need very heavy systems. That's why actually theory is hard for those things, because the scaling is Z-cubed, and hopefully in future we'll have molecules. For the EDM variation, people use cold molecular beam as of now, trapped molecular ions. In the future, hopefully ultra-cold atoms and laser-cold polyatomic molecules. Here you're actually looking for the time reversal violation, extra sources of CP violation, all the, essentially that's a supersymmetry type of tests. Looking for supersymmetry. Then tests of the CPT theorem, that's the one thing which is not tabletop, just because essentially you need antiprotons or antihydrogen for it, so it's done in CERN. And there are beautiful new experiments that you can actually measure magnetic moment of antiproton at the part per billion range. So idea is, measure the property of particle, measure the property of antiparticle, compare them. Then searches for exotic spin-independent interaction. Actually, this chapter is after the spin-dependent interaction for historical reasons in that review. And the idea is that in the future, you can actually use ultra-cold atoms as force sensors near some of the dielectric materials to actually do this better. And you can also do it with, in the future, with atom interferometry. And then spin-dependent, exotic spin-dependent interactions are mostly done for atoms with magnetometry using a spin precession. It's, again, all the extra force searches. Then you can actually compare a very precisely theory and experiment and see if the extra force, you can set limits of extra forces. Like, I can put Yukawa potential in my code and see if anything changes in terms of the comparing with experiment. And then there are new ideas how to do it with those isotope shift measurements. If you heard about nonlinearities of kink plots, I can talk about that at some point. And new ideas for networks of magnetometers and clocks, which is a GNOME experiment led by Dima Butkir. Then there is a large chapter on searches for light dark matter, which Andrei will cover. He probably will not probably talk about axions part, but about using atomic clocks, and spectroscopy measurements and networks of clocks and magnetometers for looking for transient DM signals. Then there is a much effort at testing the equivalence principle in these quantum systems. The basic idea, you take two Bose-Einstein condensates and you drop them and see if they fall the same way. And they can actually literally drop the Bose-Einstein condensate from the tower and the thing experiment actually survive. And I was really quite stunned. It's about 50 G when the thing falls. There is a Bremen tower. So they actually have the Bose-Einstein condensation thing in the box and they dropped.
Oh, they dropped the whole
thing? They dropped the whole thing. Literally, you need to be in free fall for those experiments. And they can actually recover, the thing actually survives.
What's the experiment?
It's in ZARM, Z-A-M-R. So what experiment is doing is supposed to test the equivalence principle with different types of atoms. So essentially what it does, it splits a thing and then recombines a thing and see for the phases differences. Either different isotopes or completely different atoms. or actually different spin states. So what you could do, you can actually do things which you cannot do with classical physics. Unfortunately, we are not quite yet at the limit of the torsion experiments by many orders of magnitude, but there are ideas. There is actually the first successful experiment to do it in a flying rocket. So they actually had deliver 6 minutes in free fall, about 200 kilometers, and they were able, it automatically think made by the Einstein condensate, split it and recombine it, and that's actually been done, completely on its own. Okay, well, the best one is classical, we are talking about 10 to the minus 13.
No, from these
experiments. We are still talking about 10 to the minus 8. But they do know how to get this, one of the reasons you want 10 meter thing, or 100 meter thing, you can do that much better. Essentially, you have to be in microgravity for some time. So they've been in tried effort to send this thing to space. I think we already, it's mature enough that it will work in space. Then you can do 10 to the minus 15 or so, which would be similar to the microscope mission. I think the reason it wasn't funded because of the microscope mission was funded and is in space. So, which would, yeah, this would be 10 to the minus 15. But look.
There is an experimental program on the International Space Station.
Yeah.
That deals with cold atoms. Okay. So they have started with BECs, but ultimately they want to do also atom interferometry on the International Space Station. So it would be for microgravity experiments. So.
And is the goal of that to measure the equivalence principle?
Not of those specific, right? Not right now, but the Qantas collaboration will continue on those flying rockets, or I think it's called Primus. So the Europe will try to, you know, continue to having an effort to send actually a dedicated experiment to space to look for the microgravity experiments, equivalence principle violation. So the thing which is I didn't fully appreciate before is that all of those equivalence principle from the classical tests, all of those are torsion balances. All of those which are actually free fall experiments are also not very good classically. All of those are free fall experiments for the with the, there is no way of doing a quantum version of the torsion balance. So all of those are free fall types. All of the classical free fall experiments are actually much less accurate than the classical torsion balances experiments. So here you are extending capabilities on the other hand that you can have a spin dependent version and looking at some of the unique interactions which you cannot do with classical systems. So this will progress, and I think it will get to 10 to the minus 15.
Is this macro?
No, we are still talking about millions of atoms there. So, but again, separated by... what's macro is that it actually has to be in microgravity for some time. That's why it's best to do it in space. So, but then rubidium terbium interferometry will probably get you 10 to the minus 11 with 10 meters or so, and that's already going to be two different atoms. And again, this is a quantum wave function which is falling down. So this is, in principle, different from the classical experiments. But the main idea is the same. Those are all interpreted in terms of the adverse ratio. You can reinterpret them, of course, as limits on the dark matter couplings as well. And then there are Lorentz symmetry tests, and in this case there is a standard model extension which Alan Castellecki have written. Essentially, you just write your standard model in Lagrangian, then add all of the things which will violate the Lorentz invariance and CPT without destroying the full structure of the Lagrangian. And I'll show how that looks like. The beautiful thing here that you can compare in this frameworks completely different types of tests in terms of the same restriction of the same coefficients. And here there is effort with atomic clocks, magnetometers, this is trapped ion quantum control systems, spectroscopy, rotating cavities. This is actually a pretty large effort as well. How to connect all of those limits to other things, this is actually something which you will need support from the high energy community. This is sort of completely, relatively separate from everything else. And then there are some efforts for violation of quantum statistics. We're pretty much just looking for the spin-forbidden transitions. So which are forbidden by the statistics rules, and you set a limit by looking if they're allowed very weakly. So the more precisely you can measure the frequency of those transitions, you know, the possibility of those transitions, the better would be the limit. So as you see, there is a very large effort. And this effort will continue. We have more than 1,000 of references in this review, most of those are last 10 years. So it'd be very nice to actually have input from the high energy theory community to what people should be searching for, which will have the maximum discovery potential. So in this case, in the remaining time, so I have three different examples. So perhaps I'll go through at least through the EDM one, because EDM probably it's one of the really highlights of the whole effort, because this is probably the one which does have the highest discovery potential, and I can show where we are at right now and how to improve it. What about the questions on all the other stuff? So EDM, first this is dedicated experiment. This is highly well motivated theoretically. Essentially, any variant of supersymmetry will produce you EDM, which should be visible with current or future generation experiments. So because all of those will have extra forces of the CP violation. There is actually a review in the archive which is just above EDM, which has been very recently posted as well. The basic idea for the EDM, elementary particles shouldn't have any EDM. The reason why, because you have a direction of spin, and if you have an EDM, you just don't have any other axis. So if you have a dipole moment for the elementary particle, it has to be aligned with the spin. If you reverse the time, the spin reverses to minus s, but the dipole moment does not.
So what would happen if it were not aligned?
Well, you have to have another quantum number to show the projection to the spin. The point is, as long as you actually don't have any other quantum numbers besides a spin which describes your elementary particle, it has to be aligned along the line, just according to the normal quantum mechanics.
Maybe there are some hidden quantum numbers, right?
Well, if you don't know, but
there might be more space.
Well, but then look, but then what you're saying,
just how many space?
Right, but when you're saying that is an EDM which gives you extra quantum numbers. But if it is aligned, then reversal of this leads to the fact that it has to be zero, because this reverses and this one doesn't. So the D in this case has to be zero. And that actually applies to pretty much any neutral systems. So whether it's a molecule, whether it's an atom, whether it's a quark, whether it's an electron, it should have zero EDM, period. Unless T is violated or CP is violated. That's a basic idea. The standard model for the electron essentially predicts atomic EDMs, which is like extraordinarily small. About say 10 to the minus 40. So if you see an EDM now, this is absolute electron EDM now, this is absolutely definitive signal of new physics. The main reason why people have been so interested in this, it's essentially solve the problem, why do we have so much matter? And for that, we need an extra CP violation in the system. So all of the supersymmetries, for example, this type of diagram, you have a fermion, let's say electron, that's you have a super partner of your electron, that's just normal photon, that's your CP violating phase, which from low energy super, you know, SUSY breaking, and this is your either super partners for, you know, for the photons or for the Z, and then you get your electron back. So this diagram will produce an EDM. There are a number of other diagrams which produce EDM too. So with SUSY, you have a number of CP violating phases. All the multi-Higgs theory will allow you to do those things as well. So any version of the supersymmetry, which also will, of course, produce you the lightest supersymmetric particle being your WIMP dark matter, will produce an EDM. If we talk about measuring those things in atoms and molecules, a lot of those constituents of atoms and molecules cause EDMs. For example, you have electrons, so you have electron EDM, you have proton and neutron EDM, and then you also have just PT, T violating electron-nuclear interaction, or you can also write T violating nuclear-nuclear interaction. So for the purposes of this discussion, we are talking about the cases when only electron EDM will be significant. But technically, this is how you reduce actual measurable EDMs into fundamental theory constituents. So if you have an EDM in a paramagnetic atom, meaning you have one outside valence electron, or in the similar case for the molecules, all you need in order to reduce it to electron EDM, it's atomic and molecular theory. Our number for thallium is accurate to 3%. So I can be absolutely sure that essentially whatever you measure for the atoms, you can directly actually get the electron EDM with the uncertainty of experiment plus additional 3%. So there is a very direct and very understandable reduction how to reduce EVMs of atoms into electron EVMs of atoms into actual electron EVMs. For the molecules, the uncertainty may be 10, 15%, something, maybe 20%. But it's very well understood how to actually do those calculations. Molecules are just harder to calculate with. If you have a neutron, you need a QCD to reduce the quark EVM. If you're measuring diamagnetic atoms, the atomic theory is actually very reliable. Nuclear theory, unfortunately, there are problems reducing those to individual constraints. And again, you actually technically could have some CP violating phase for the neutron. You're not prohibited to do so. It's just very small, which creates your strong CP problem. By some reason, strong interaction doesn't violate CP while it should. So technically, you're setting limits on theta QCD with those types of experiments as well. So I will only talk about this. So in here, we propagate from EV scale to the all the way to TV scale. And with the new generation of experiments, you can probe things at a PEV scale, which you will not be able to do with Collider. That, actually, I have no idea. I was wondering about that yesterday. So I honestly stole that from Micromatis. Right, yeah, I think this is just scale. I mean, when we talk about the atoms, we are talking about, the ionization energy of atom, it's less than EV, so, for example.
That is the size of the galaxy, right?
Yeah, well, as I said, I was trying to cut it off, so I decided to cut off, just leave it as it is. But yeah, I'm not sure where the 10 to minus 24 goes from.
So can you say again why nuclear theory issues still affect periodic atoms and molecules?
Okay, like because in this case, those are closed shell systems. So the electron EDM does not contribute. All the EDM comes from the nuclei. So there are some specific atomic enhancements which have accidentally closed purity levels, which we can account for, we understand how to account for. But essentially, you have to calculate what the shift moment is, and then separate that into the actual individual EDMs of protons and neutrons. And also, as you see, there is also just nuclear-nuclear violating interaction. And this is extremely hard to extract. Essentially, no one agrees even on the sign of those coefficients in there. And the reason why it's so hard to do nuclear calculations, they have no mean field. In my case, I have a nuclei. I have a cloud of electrons. And I can describe that pretty well with, say, Hadron fork. And then on top of the Hadron fork, we do very elaborate calculation for what I was left. That does not exist in nuclear physics.
For the things on the right hand side of this plot, the point is just that those do contribute. There will be a contribution from the nucleus and the.
Here it's completely screened out. It's screened out completely. So it's only electron which actually gives it to you, or the electron which is unbound electron which sits just inside the molecule. And sits in the effective field.
It's not zero, but it's
right. Yeah, but it's right. So it's negligible compared to everything else. So it's because the shift theorem, I mean, everything just gets screened completely. So the if you have nuclear EDM and the electron cloud just readjusts and screen it out.
Yeah.
Unless you have some relativistic effect or you have deformation, then it appears and so on. So, but for all purposes, just electrons will kill it.
Yeah.
So because it just readjusts the distribution. So there has been tremendous progress. The past EDM measurement improved the previous result by a factor of 10, and they are going to release new data hopefully within 6 months, which probably could be, don't quote me on that, another factor of 10. So to improve even by a factor of 2 in neutron EDM is going to be a major effort. But here, it's been improved by a factor of 10. We know how to improve by a factor of 10 to the 4. And let's just very briefly describe how that works. Here your thorium oxide molecule, and inside of it, you have this one electron, which is essentially, if you put an electric field, this creates an effective field, and molecule is almost 100% polarized. It's hard to polarize atoms, it's very easy to polarize molecule. So there is this one electron which is kind of sits in this huge effective field. We are talking about GeV per centimeter, gigavolts per centimeter. This is a field we cannot create in a lab. That's why you use this molecule. And this atom has to behave for this. And then all you do, you just reverse the thing. And now the shift is in different direction, measure the difference. So the basic idea, it's actually slightly more complicated. Put it in an electric field, reverse the field, measure the difference. What they actually do is they create superposition of two states, let it precess, and then reverse it, measure the phase, reverse the field, do the same thing, and do it many, many times. So the reason why that actually works is that this is a very specific molecule. So enormous theory effort have gone to select in which system you should be doing it. This is one of the best examples of the precision physics experiments. Then a lot of thought went into this specific experiment. They also had the previous effort in lead oxide, which never quite worked that well. And in this case, the only problem which you have, this is a molecule you absolutely cannot laser cool. So it has to be done with cold molecular buffer gas beams, which have been developed specifically for these purposes. The whole actual scheme is much more complicated. You actually have two different levels, and this is why this molecule. So in this case, it creates a superposition of this level and this level, and then let just the spin process recombine, measure the phase difference, reverse the field, do the same thing. So reverse electric field, reverse magnetic field, and see how things change, and do this for several months. This experiment actually runs blind, which is probably the only type of experiments which run blind in atomic physics are EDM experiment. Now, let just me explain how small that effect is. If you take the electron and blow it to the size of the solar system, how much do you think non-spherical it is with this EDM? So because the basic idea of EDM that this is not point charge is some sort of cloud. So take a guess. If you blow the electron to the size of a solar system, what's it in say meters, the size of the effect? Guesses?
If it's the Earth, I think it's an angstrom.
Well, no, that's the size of the whole solar system. It's a spherical within the width of a human hair. Right. So, but that's the whole solar system. That just, you know, we are talking about 10 to the minus 29 here. It's a really, really small thing. And this is actually from archive of trying to, okay. I'm going to have a disclaimer which from this paper. So all of this is conditional on constraints, loopholes, and so on. So those are EDM limits for the previous EDM limits before this experiment, for the super partners here, for the in our lepton sector, and this is now moves into this. So it's above the not only significantly above the LHC, it's significantly above the naturalist limit. And the CP violating phase, I think, goes into about 10 to the minus 3. With this case, which is also, so there is definitely a naturalness problem. There are all the other things you can actually get from the experiments. You can actually get some of the specific couplings to the supersymmetric type particles for if you know what the standard model coupling is. And there are some implications for the whole CP violation and baryogenesis process as well.
So to make that, you need to know both the selectron and the
CTO. Yes.
Because
you can have a one loop and two loop corrections for just the simplest the one loop thing. You can just electron. Yeah, you do have electron super partners that you on the bottom. You will have
The bar is easier right. Two loop than I only care about. I think these are the bar is easier.
No, sir, but that doesn't work for the scales.
I think this is 2013, the article.
Let's
Yeah, you need the multiple Higgs to do EDM. You cannot do it with one Higgs.
Yes, That is the other problem. Even with the Barzi interpretation, you actually need to know what the extended Higgs sector looks like.
I'm sure there are multiple caveats into producing this diagram. But just to show essentially where we are, four orders of magnitude, you'll be like over there. And the one thing which I would like to show, and this is one of the reasons actually this field is so highly motivated in atomic physics. So somebody many years ago produced this. So this is would be the best thing which you can get from particle physics. I honestly could not trace where they come from. Andrew, do you know where they come from? Because all the experimentalists in the field always show this.
Look, I know where it came from. That was Dave who made it.
Dave actually, yeah. Right, but he needed some input from...
He got it from, so he sent emails to...
Everyone?
Okay. Bunch of particle physicists.
So that was, I've seen that thing for more than 15 years at this point,
yeah.
So.
But actually, this was That's a really great idea.
Right, because...
provide motivation.
Right, because you see, the reason why it's a great idea is this. This is very easy to explain to your finding agency. I ruled out the minimum, you know, the naive supersymmetry. So, or again, there are many caveats in the building this plot, but this is where the current limit is. It's actually very well within the predictions of where you should see the EDM. That's why I'm saying this is the highest discovery potential type of experiment, and this is the next generations. So the next one should come out somewhere here, hopefully, at least what that's what John Doerr promises. He did promise it in 2 years, they actually had 5 years, but they actually taken data, they're already blind. They sorted out all the new systematics at this level. So there is also another experiment which with thorium fluoride plus, which is an ion experiment done in JOA, which is still not quite there, but also will improve sensitivity. So this is ultimate statistical sensitivity. Whether they're going to reach it with the current setup is a question, because the question whether any new systematics will appear, but at this level, they already actually know everything which they have. There is a completely new idea from, you know, exceptionally bright students and postdocs which actually worked in that group. Nick Huxter just got positioned in Caltech, and he will do this experiment. This is the experiment which should be done. If you do one high precision experiment in atomic physics, this is the one to do. The reason being because that combines two features. It has a special structure when you have those two states which shift a different way when you reverse the field. In this case, you don't have to actually do actual electric field reversal. All you need to do, you put the field and put the superposition of state and measure the phase. That's why the ACME is so much more precise than anything else. Unfortunately, a lot of different molecules which would be perfect for laser cooling don't have this. So you actually need to go to polyatomic things, for example, terbium or H, but don't quote me on that. So it has to be one heavy, and then the thing is kind of like one atom, one atom, one atom. It looks like something like this. And you have the bending levels that that thing can actually bend different ways. So there are those special bending levels which produce exactly the same co-magnetometry structure that you actually can rule out a lot of systematics just because you have this internal level structure. And that's the one which you can laser cool.
And that's why it would be so much better,
because it's laser cooled. Right, because it's laser cooled, essentially you have all the incredible mechanism which you now have for the laser for cold atoms would then apply. So because the problem is you have a cold beam, you have dispersion of the beam, you have, so whatever done now, it's not trapped. So you do have a flux, you don't have a beam like perfectly, for example, on your target, etc. You have all the major things. In that case, you will actually have cold and trapped molecules. People have tried to do it with atoms. David Weiss was trying to do it with ultra-cold cesium, but he is not very well funded for that, and they blew up the electric plates for the experiment. They could do 10 to the minus 30, but with cesium atoms, you just don't have large enough enhancement, which you actually have in the molecules. So that paper claimed four orders of magnitude. It's not necessarily clear to me from which point they're starting count for orders of magnitude, from this or from that. But they're saying essentially instead of the TeV scale, which is about, 30 TeV or so, they can actually do 10 to the minus 12 scale. This is a projection, but I think this is a few months away.
Yeah.
Ultimate sensitivity they can do to this, just essentially with not significant modification of experiment. So right now they're limited by systematics and not by, so they're limited by, you know, how many times, how much you do the measurements, but they've checked systematics to this level. They don't know whether new systematics will arise. And those were complicated, but relatively it's not minor improvements, it did take 5 years, so very difficult, but it's not rebuilding the apparatus completely in this case. There is also ultra-cold ytterbium fluoride, which is going to be about somewhere like right here.
Sorry, which?
Ytterbium fluoride, and it's going to be called phantom. You put the molecules up and then drop back. Heinz, you know, at Heinz in UK.
Imperial College, so.
And this is one of the examples. If we could have a plot like this for other types of experiments, that's this one thing which is the best motivation which you can produce for my experimental colleagues to actually do those experiments. Yes, I understand that for the dark matter and for the other extra force searches, you can also divide it by the arbitrary large mass. and it's very hard to make any predictions. But this is so much, this is not quite the version of the parameter space. Yes, there is a parameter space because honestly you have electronuclear interaction in there, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, for the baryogenesis part, you have the special curves and so on. But this is something which my community have seen for the past 15 years. That's what they used to. It would be very nice to have it. I mean, if we could have it for the variation of fundamental constants, at least now there are parameters plots of couplings of dilatons to the dark matter, but this is something which is just a lot of those plots and people get buried in them. For Lorentz violation, if you do a minimal supersymmetric model, you have relatively few parameters. If you have non-minimal, then you have 120, which is just too many to measure. And again, it's something which, one other thing which can motivate people, if you're saying, I can improve this by orders of magnitude, that's also a relatively good motivation. But again, if I didn't see the signal, what did I learn? And that's what we actually need to do. So I also have examples for Lorentz violation and for the proton radius puzzle, but we're out of time, so whatever you want to do.
We have cookies at 3:15, and I think that's the hard cutoff.
Okay.
Do a little radius.
Sure. Okay. Let's. So Lorentz violation. So the only thing which I would like to say, Alan Kostelecki wrote essentially, just instead of this Lagrangian, have this Lagrangian, and you have all possible terms, which you can add, and those coefficients now can be extracted from any types of the experiments and compared. And that's actually been a lot of help because we relatively understand how to do the atomic Hamiltonian, how to do the extraction. So, okay, so this is our quantum information thing, proton radius puzzle. So first, how do you actually measure the radius of the proton? First, you can just scatter electrons of protons, but in this case, you're never actually at a zero momentum transfer, so you need to extrapolate. So the other way to do it is to do very precision measurements in hydrogen. So in hydrogen, the potential which is seen by electron doesn't quite go to infinity because there is a finite size correction, essentially time which your electron spends inside the nuclei. Therefore, this is type of correction which can be calculated from QED. So the basic idea, measure the transition energies between different levels of hydrogen, calculate collection to those energies, need to know QD really, really well, extract the correction due to proton radius, extract the RMS radius, repeat for many transitions, and make the average. People have been doing it for 30 years. So if you actually write your equations, the energy level from 1s to any transition for the any state is proportional to two parameters, Weber constant and your proton radius, which reaches your lamp shift. So essentially what you need to do, you measure two different transitions. This is 1s to 2s has been measured to 15 significant figures. We believe in that, period. So what you do, you need to measure some other transition to extract the proton radius, and people have done that, and they measure the proton radius late 90s or so. So at this point, that's been accepted as this is a proton radius, you put it in the data tables, and kind of people forgot about it for a while, until people decided, well, instead of electron having a muon, can make you measure the proton radius so much better. And the reason because it's so much better, because it's proportional to the mass difference cubed. So the enhancement is tremendous. So it's much, much larger effect in this case. So the effect just the finite size of the nuclei. Okay, and this is the experiment, muonic hydrogen, done in Switzerland. So you have your laser, shine your laser at your muonic hydrogen. This is now in 2s state. And when you're perfectly on resonance with the transition, atom jumps to the different state, and then it jumps back to 1s state and measures the X-ray photon. If you don't see the photon, you didn't make the transition. It's a very, very clean experiment. So you shine your laser until you start seeing X-ray photons coming out.
Is this done on single atoms or a gas?
Well, no, this is actually special. So muonic hydrogen, I do assume they have a number of them. So that's why you actually have to be in Switzerland, because you actually need, this is not tabletop. You need a muon beam for that. So.
But it's probably
do you know how many? I honestly don't. Well, I think it stopped in some probably buffer gas. So I don't know the detail. Do you know, Andrei? Okay. So, but the point is that if this transition is not in resonance, you will not see those photons. And initially, they actually spent many, many years trying to do this experiment, and they've seen nothing. And they are told that they are going to, they are not going to get muon time anymore. I mean, how many? I mean, this is 6-micron laser. This is not easy to do. This is very special laser. They actually thought they built the laser wrong, because they rebuilt the laser completely different. They've still seen nothing. And in this case, it turned out the reason why they have been seen nothing, they've been 4 line widths off resonance. They've been completely off resonance. Because the proton radius, they put it in the, take it from co-data, they put it in the calculations, and they thought they knew what the wavelength should be. And this is a proton radius puzzle. That's what the co-data think, which is proton radius should be. We are talking about 84 versus 88. This is not subtle here. This is really a lot. This is the average average from hydrogen spectroscopy, and that's the scattering. That's why everyone was happy with the numbers, because scattering perfectly agrees with hydrogen spectroscopy. Co-data averaged everything in 2010, and this is the muonic hydrogen. This is two different type, you know, two different transitions.
And the relativistic effects and the calculations.
It's all been done. Control. Yeah, it's all in control. This is the QED uncertainty. We are talking about 100 sigma here. The sigma for muonic hydrogen is very, very, very small. You need to be 100 sigma away to get here. That is about 4 sigma away. So this is a proton radius puzzle.
There's a question about how you really parameterize
the photon just in terms of the square. Yes, and when I talk to my hadronic physics colleagues, the first thing which they say, there is no such a thing as a proton radius. So, but, right, well, it's expression, it's a Fourier factor. Right. It's a specifically, they define it as a specific Fourier factor from the scattering experiments, which should exactly correspond to what we are plugging in the numbers.
About the scattering right. Experiments, which have a lot of problems. Mm-hmm. Just think, these experiments, how do you really understand the discrepancy? This is a discrepancy if you assume that you can characterize the Torres distribution just by the mean square.
But you have to be able to ask how big the next term is in the experiment.
Yeah,
but to a muon, which is actually, it's not the mass of the muon. It's not
but the Bohr radius is still quite big compared to the
right.
Nuclear size.
It's a pi on the muon. Nuclear size is.
But there's an alpha for the Bohr radius.
Right,
so for the nuclear.
In scattering experiments, our distribution is this weird dipole thing, which makes no sense. Why should I? I mean, I am just so. My friend told me that's the problem. This can't be used as an independent discrepancy, it just tells you something about the profile.
My understanding that people have looked in the first one they looked at some nuclear polarization effects, and that had been accounted for in the analyzing. But in terms of other, I don't know if there are any loopholes in this case. So
there was immediately a paper on Zarka saying that this could be explained away by some weird Cherk distribution inside the proton. And for some reason, they did not. No. It was really just trying to explain this away, right? So, mm-hmm. And people include there is this. I think it's called Zmach radius. There is also
the Zmach radius had been measured. Magnetization radius had been measured
comes,
as well.
Comes into play. So these effects are included in those computations. So. To what level to trust the existing model? That's a good question, but nevertheless.
Yes, I mean, you have to put some model for the proton, which you think, and then you have some additional polarization effects. So for the best of our knowledge, how we think the proton should look like, that should work. And again, this is a monumental size of the effect here.
It's a 5% shift.
Right. So what my personal opinion was that hydrogen just get it wrong. And if I show you next slide, you can see why. Okay, maybe next slide. So as I can, the discovery was century depending how far that goes. It's much less impressive if you actually look at how the hydrogen data actually averaged out. So the core data, and this is a blue line, that's a core data, averaged all of those transitions. As you see, the red thing, this is a muon. So a lot of the hydrogen experiments themselves are actually consistent with muon. That's why it's not just a problem with the hydrogen measurements. But then the world average, when you average all of this, and it's averaged properly, and the chi-square are perfect in this case, so it's really either a sort of random distribution, then you end up with this good thing. Now, comparing... Right. Right, sorry.
That looks to me like a once in a
lifetime. Right. But there is a continuation of this. So as soon as I look at it, and I understand, I know my colleagues who've done the averaging at NIST, like Peter Moore and the company, and I said, oh, that's okay, never mind then the whole thing, and just let's wait until the next measurements. And again, for the muonic hydrogen, this is where spectroscopy is, and that's what the line widths. They're really, really away from the muonic line widths here. So for the muon to be wrong, you have to shift the whole line over there, which is really, you know, kind of unclear how to do. So that's a new measurement. So I said, okay, that's been done in the 90s, that was pre-frequency comp, and people have remeasured that, and this is new measurement which is perfectly agreeing with muonic hydrogen. I said, right, that's it, all done. And that's the next measurement, which is right there. So right now there are two new measurements, which actually now, well, we're still about, still a couple of sigmas away. This is a measurement on 2S4P transition, this is a measurement on 1S3S transition, this is a Germany group, this is a Paris group, and they right now, two new measurements I disagree, that just appeared on the archive. Those people are really know what they're doing, so I'm...
What is the theoretical system error?
What?
What is the theoretical system?
A theoretical systematic error goes from QED and for...
QED. Just parameterizing things in terms of
From the
RM squared.
Well,
I'll leave you.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. He will some.
He's cost, yeah. Right. So, and the series pretty much. So this is QED, it has been tested for. So you are talking about a specific thing, but nevertheless, there is a lot of series also that goes there. Right, so yeah. QED and people have rejected, so different groups have rejected
computations. But yes, it's a great question. Whether this is properly, RMS radio properly describes the protons. And but people have been looking at it for the past 5 years, and so far they haven't. Right. So you have to, you know, they. I think the nuclear effects have been looked for in terms of the understanding of at least. Okay, so he will send a reference.
Is there a good high-click ridges on particle theory?
So that kind of stuff, the mistake was doing it with bosonic electrons. If they.
No, I'm just saying.
Yeah, if you do it with fermionic electrons, the effect goes away, which was kind of clear from. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Oh, so they no longer think.
Oh, no, they yeah. That's,
okay, so as you see, there is a very large effort with the Amos-Heron experiment to search for physics beyond the standard model, and we need much more direction from the beyond the standard model physics going this way and also analyzing what did we actually learn from it. And some of my efforts of organizing the more of exchange of ideas, and thank you so much for organizing this workshop. That's, you know, I'm very much looking forward to the remaining 2 weeks. I mean, it's absolutely great to be here, and I've learned about dark radiation yesterday, and I'm actually much looking forward to the remaining workshop and the talk. But precision measurement group on fundamental constants, which we are about 500 people, we are about two-thirds AMO, and the rest is scattered through the high energy nuclear physics and the other communities. We are now organizing annual workshop, and in even years, it's a day before the DAMOP, which is our divisional atomic physics meeting. All the years, it's a day before the April meeting. So we've done tests of fundamental symmetries. It's just one day, full day research meeting. We've done ultra-light dark matter, which was very nicely attended. This year we're running it at DAMOP, and next year we are going to run at April meeting. As I've heard, it's just been separated from the rest of the meeting and we'll be in Denver. So we'll be the day before it starts. And I'm going to run new ideas in dark matter searches. Dima Busker had been my co-chair for the past two meetings, and we would love participation from, of course, this community, so let the people know. For now, this the program for the DAMOP one is already online. It's possible to come just for the meeting and not for DAMOP. We have a...
Registration fee is just $75.
Yeah, and 25 for students. So the group actually gave me money to students only pay $25 for the day of the workshop. It's also in Florida this year, so. Okay, if you have ideas for this one, for the next one, I already decided on this particular, you know, title. We have generally about 10, 11 talks in one half an hour talks and posters for students. So we usually previously had like, what, maybe 55, 60 people last time. So probably more for the AMOP. We'll see. Thank you so much. Okay, and then Andrei will continue.
Discussion next Wednesday. The only thing we have going on today is Joe's ride at 4, so those of you who want to ride up Old San Marcos will meet in front of KIPP, and my job is to make sure everyone who wants to go is able to.